Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, Parliament cracks the whip. Mayor Morero has just 2 weeks to end Johannesburg's water chaos. The ANC facing warnings of arrogance and factionalism. The UK's recognition of Palestine is hailed as historic, but critics ask, what is the real impact? And South Africa's vet crisis intensifies as the regulatory body is disbanded. It's Monday, the 22nd of September.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, Parliament has given Johannesburg Mayor Dado Morero 14 days to come up with concrete solutions to the city's ongoing water supply crisis. The disruption has been linked to infrastructure delay, financial mismanagement, high leakage losses, overstretched resources, the list goes on and on. Well, let's explore this in a little more detail. Portfolio Committee Chairperson Leonard Basson is with us. Mr. Basson, a very warm welcome. That 14-day deadline now from Parliament, what specific measurable steps are you expecting the mayor to report on?
Good morning to your listeners and good morning to you as well. Yes, they need to supply us with full detail on their water plans, their financials. We've got a huge concern over the 4 billion that was swept out of Joburg Water's account. And, you know, that is not in line with legislation. There was no adjustment budget to that. So we will wait now for his reports. Before we will receive his reports, we will have a meeting with National Treasury and the Auditor General, because we believe that what they've done is illegal. They cannot take money away that's been budgeted for. And then, as the mayor said, we use that money to pay salaries and pension funds and the water board. And if anything is left, we'll pay our contractors. So we also requested from them to give us a list of all the contractors they have appointed and the outstanding money on these contracts and a timeline when that money will be paid. And then we also requested them to give us a timeline when they will ring fence water and not use it for something else.
And if none of this information is forthcoming or you're not satisfied with the information provided, what's the next step?
Well, I think we won't receive the information as requested, so we will summons Joburg Water back to Parliament, and then we will have to look what consequence management we can apply to Joburg Water and Mayor even investigating, and we will have that discussion with National Treasury whether you can place Joburg Water under administration.
Do you think we're fast approaching that point where that could conceivably happen?
We will have to do something drastically because the people are suffering and there's just no urgency from Joburg Water. They just promise people. And I must say that they've got an excellent turnaround plan and we all agree to the plan, but it's just the words written on paper because it's not funded. There's no funds available. And you know that if you've got 26.6 billion infrastructure deficit that you need to deal with upgrading your infrastructure, then you don't take away 4 billion and utilize it somewhere else in the metro.
The mayor at the weekend, Mr. Bosson, saying that water supply has improved in the city. Do you believe him?
I don't believe him. I don't believe him. Saturday morning, we had a meeting on SABC and where he said that, and then the residents that was included in this debate said that it's just not true.
The mayor, while saying that water supply has improved, is talking against a backdrop of delays, aging pipes, illegal connections. As you interrogate this issue more closely, which, in your opinion, the committee's opinion, are of the highest priority and which would need to be actively addressed first?
Well, firstly, most of their reservoirs are leaking. They've got a water loss of 44.6%. That's their current non-revenue water in City of Joburg. It's 44.8%, and of which 33% of that water is just going down the drain into the ground. So you've got to fix that. The major problem is their reservoirs. There should be an urgent look at the reservoirs, how they can fix those reservoirs and seal those reservoirs. Joburg Water can pump as many water they want, as much water they want to into those reservoirs, and it will just leak out. It will never reach the residents. So priority would be close down a reservoir, fix the reservoir, and divert the water from other reservoirs and fix the reservoir one by one. But that is the crucial that we would look at, and we will also, after our meeting with National Treasury, we'll see what means there is for us and what recommendations can we do to Department of Water and Sanitation. Because if we don't step in now, it'll become a bigger crisis. We're getting into a summer season and, water evaporates and all that kind of stuff. But we really now need to take charge of this and make sure that if they can't fix it, we must get means to fix this.
At any point, are you engaging with the business community? Because this crisis that the city is facing now has a direct financial implication, doesn't it?
So we as a committee have not done that, but we intend to come to Joburg on the end of October. I know it's a month away, but that's unfortunately when we've got oversight time. We are coming to Joburg and then we will do that. Although I must say that the president has appointed a committee that is co-chaired by Dr. Sean Phillips of Water and Sanitation, and they are having discussions on a weekly basis with business as well as the residents and concerned groups within Johannesburg.
The mayor is also blaming former administrations for the crisis that the city finds itself in. What do you read into that?
Well, we know that this problem is ongoing for about 10 to 15 years. But that does not take the blame away, or you can't blame them. You are sitting in the driving seat now. You are taking away 4 billion out of that entity. It's not taken away 15 years ago. It's taken away this financial year when you are in charge. So, although we know it's an ongoing problem, but you're not assisting to resolve this problem if you unfund that entity, that Joburg Water, to do the work they need to do. They have appointed contractors to assist them to fix these leaks, but they are not paying them. Those people have left the sites because they are not paid. So, whether you want to blame previous administrations is irrelevant now, because what are you doing now? You are not paying your contractors. You are sweeping away money out of Joburg water. You can't blame that on previous administrations because it's something that you are doing at the moment.
Thank you very much indeed. That's the Portfolio Committee Chairperson for Water, Leonard Basson. I appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
On to politics now, and South Africa's governing party is once again under the spotlight, and not necessarily for the right reasons. At a recent gathering, what was billed as a show of strength has been described by political commentator and author Professor Susan Boysen as nothing less than, in her words, a dance with death. She argues the party is edging closer to political irrelevance with arrogance, factionalism and complacency on full display. Professor Boysen, a very warm welcome to you. Those are strong words, a dance with death. Are you suggesting the ANC's demise is now inevitable?
Jeremy, it is quite a big possibility. As I've often said in analyses, it is always possible that the ANC could still recover. However, if it is on the road to recovery, I have not seen any of the evidence yet. And the kind of evidence one would have to see for the ANC to reverse this inexorable trend downward. Each election, they've been going further down and further down, and we haven't seen a recovery yet. Should there be a recovery, I would expect to see, if we look at local government and forthcoming local government elections, possibly late in next year or early the year after, there must be a working system of local government, for example, where municipalities would slot into a system where they have a sufficient income base, where they sufficiently and wisely spend the income that they do have, for example, on maintenance and development of infrastructure, much less time and much better discernment exercised in appointment of officials and councillors. And none of these factors that will, no doubt, instill a lot of trust in voters when they go to the polls. None of these are evident at this stage.
Do you believe at this point then, Professor, the ANC has the capacity to renew itself, or do you think that that moment is long past?
When in politics, one learns hardly ever to say never, but the capacity, if it is there, to renew itself, to instill renewed trust and credibility in assuring voters that they are there to serve and serve wisely and to the benefit of the people, that evidence I do not see. So at this stage, I really see ANC in next year's local government elections going further down. Further means that they won't disappear, they won't die as such, but die in the sense of not showing renewal, not showing that imagination and commitment that will inspire new support.
And Professor, where then does this leave the leadership of President Ramaphosa? Is something looming, do you think, on that front, which might necessitate his departure?
We have seen so much speculation about that, Jeremy. Also, because of this event at the Nasrec Dome, where the whole collection of ANC councillors from across the country came together, it is a sense of death that we saw in Cyril Ramaphosa's words. It was his words that inspired the thrust of this article, this analysis. And that's when he said to his councillors, if you do not do anything, we, that means the ANC, are dead. And this then also reflected on President Ramaphosa, because the words and his approach in full view of the whole country, all of the media collected there, television screens, microphones running, and said basically that, yes, unless you do something, we are dead, and implying, suggesting that he's really disconnected, because that type of platform, that type of reprimand is not to be used in public. It's fine and would perfectly honest and appropriate for the ANC and President Ramaphosa to do that in private closed meetings with their councillors, even if it's more or less guaranteed to leak at this stage of the ANC's lack of internal coherence and unity. But a public platform is not the place where that is to be. And there has been a massive amount of fallout because of those remarks by Ramaphosa that the ANC is to go and learn from the DA. Of course, the DA, being the brilliant opportunists that they are, already we saw that in their preliminary election campaigning, that's quoting Ramaphosa saying that if you, the voters, don't believe us, the DA, as they were saying, that we govern best, go and ask the president. That is serious damage. And that is being held against President Ramaphosa in turn in the ANC. The problem in the ANC, and that is possibly one of the biggest indictments of the ANC that we see at the stage of the political game, is that there is such a paucity of alternative leadership emerging in the ANC.
And Professor, what do you make then of Helen Zille's decision and election to stand as the mayor of Johannesburg under the flag of the DA this weekend?
Well, I think that it was opportunistic, great opportunistic timing. They used the moment, also used the fact that Dada Marrero, mayor of Johannesburg, task team, war team to prepare Johannesburg, the city, for the G20 meetings, not quite taking off, and then combined that with Cyril Ramaphosa's remarks. It was an excellent moment in terms of publicity to launch a campaign. Simultaneously, we know that the DA is not always a magical bullet, a golden bullet that will just come and, because they're in power, things will start going right. Much of the decay that we see in Johannesburg, I believe, started at the start in a time of rather extended DA governance of the city. It didn't collapse. There wasn't the extent of decay that we see at the moment. But the term of DA governance in Johannesburg was definitely not always, if at all, exemplary. So it's not a magical guarantee that things will be better under the DA. But certainly, these are very, very desperate times for the city of Johannesburg, and the DA has chosen a moment opportunistically well to launch this campaign.
Professor Susan Boysen, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The South African Veterinary Council, it's the body meant to regulate vets and safeguard animal health, is currently leaderless. It's the council, or the council's term expired at the end of July, yet no leadership has been installed or new leadership. Elections were run twice, but the minister has refused to recognize the results, asking for another rerun. What does it mean? Well, it leaves a regulatory vacuum and I imagine serious implications for governance and accountability. I'm going to talk now to the chairperson of Parliament's Agriculture Committee, Dina Pule. A very warm welcome to you. How did we get to this point with no council in place? The process, if I remember, began back in February.
Yes, the portfolio committee learned about this challenge immediately around towards the end of July, I think around the 31st of July, if not the 30th of July. And we then had to wait for the minister to indicate to us as to what was happening. Unfortunately, we could not get the response to the minister, and instead we received a letter that was copied to myself as the chairperson of the portfolio committee, the letter that comes from the South African Veterinary Council administrator or CEO, Mr. Minya. And the letter was addressed to the president. So it didn't actually give us much leeway for us to respond to that because it was not directed to us. We were only copied, and I think the speaker and others were copied there. So we waited for the presidency to be able to respond so that we can also respond. However, what we did, which is our responsibility, we then had to write a letter to the minister and request that the minister comes to the portfolio committee to at least give us, you know, some information about what has happened, because in terms of the legislation, the minister was supposed to be part of the processes, and the minister would have communicated with the previous council and be notified of all the processes. And we learned that the council, or through the CEO, the minister was informed. So we didn't know what was happening on the side of the minister.
That's the procedural side of it. Who do you believe then is to blame for this vacuum? Is it the minister, the department, or the council itself?
Look, Jeremy, I want to believe that both the South African Veterinary Council and the minister have a responsibility to make sure that elections go well, especially at the end of the term of a previous council. And so to respond to your question directly, is that I think that both the minister and the South African Veterinary Services owe us an explanation of what has happened. And that is why, as a portfolio committee, we had requested, we had written to the minister to request him to come and brief us on the 27th of August. But he was not available. He apologized. And subsequently, even the other meetings that set of the portfolio committee, because we sit every Tuesday of the week, he was not available to come to the portfolio committee, apologized. So we couldn't speak to him. But he also responded, Jeremy, to the South African Veterinary Council. And he also, the minister also copied us. Where he was indicating to the South African Veterinary Service Council that he would like them to restart the process of the elections. Otherwise, he will seek legal advice if they don't. So we ended there, but we requested him to come. Now, Jeremy, the challenge of this impasse between the minister and the council, or the lack of council, is that it affects the farmers. It affects the country as a whole. It affects animal health. I mean, we are in the middle of of a challenge of foot and mouth disease, the outbreak, and we need the Veterinary Council to assist in the process to regulate and make sure that everything goes well. But if there is a vacuum, there is no council, then it creates a governance issue. How is the CEO going to work without a council? Where does he take instruction from? How far can he then be able to, you know, to do the work that the council is supposed to do without the council? It's a problem.
So,
but also it's a problem that the minister must be able to tackle as soon as possible.
So what concrete steps then will your committee take if the minister continues to delay the appointments, given the risks that you've outlined to me?
Okay, we have requested, the minister is going to, we have invited the department on the 7th of October. We hope that the minister will come on the 7th so that he can then be able to give us the brief on what is happening. Look, Jeremy, I believe that he will come on the 7th because it is also in his interest to make sure that there is stability at the South African Veterinary Services. I think that he may have had his own problems at work. But we would like him to come, and I want to believe that on the 7th he will appear before the portfolio committee so that we can deal with these issues once and for all. It's very important. It affects everyone else as much as it affects us. I can tell you, Jeremy, that there are many challenges there with the veterinary services. Besides the fact that there's an impasse here between them and the minister, and that we also don't have the council, there are issues around the veterinary council that we need the council to deal with. In the last meeting where we made questions about why do we have the exodus of veterinarians that are going outside the country, and they indicated that there are many of them. And we said, what is it that you are preparing to do to avoid them moving? Because as you would know, out of the 140 or 150 that they produce every year, about 100 or so, they leave. And we ask them the question, how are you going to deal with it? We also ask them a question around, and the minister was there. We asked the minister that they must do something. And they told us, no, look, these veterinary doctors, they leave and go to other countries, Australia, New Zealand, and the others, because of the salaries that they're being offered.
Let me ask you one last question. Does your committee believe this is part of broader governance failure, given that the National Agricultural Marketing Council also has no permanent council?
Yeah, we take an issue. It's an ongoing concern for us as a portfolio committee. We cannot have, Jeremy, institutions or entities that do not have councils or that do not have boards, because then it's a governance breach. How, like I asked the question, how do we expect that CEO at South African Veterinary Service to be working without a council? I mean, he's definitely going to do a lot of things that are not supposed to be done by him, but by the council, and that is a problem.
Thank you very much indeed. That's the chairperson of Parliament's Agriculture Committee, Dina Pule. I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
On now to a pivotal diplomatic move made by the United Kingdom, the decision under the Prime Minister Keir Starmer to formally recognise a Palestinian state. It's a decision that's been described as symbolic, moral and even overdue, but also one whose practical impact is being questioned. What does it mean for the people on the ground in Palestine, in Israel as well? Can it advance peace or risk exacerbating tensions? I want to unravel this, and I'm in conversation now with Zinat Adam, who's Deputy Executive Director of the Afro-Middle East Center. Zinat, the Prime Minister, as I've just mentioned, and welcome to you, says this is a moral obligation that keeps this two-state solution alive. In your view, does the recognition substantially advance peace, or do you think it's more symbolic?
I think that this recognition comes at a time when most of these countries are grappling with trying to deal with their own complicity in the genocide in Gaza. And so for me, this is actually distraction. And it comes 108 years after Britain endorsed the Balfour Declaration, which is why we have the situation that we do. It comes more than 75 years after Britain had recognized the State of Israel. And we're often asked, do the Palestinians acknowledge the right of Israel to exist? The question then comes, does Israel and has the international community recognize the right of Palestinians to exist until this declaration by the United Kingdom, Canada and Australia this week?
So some critics are saying that recognition without conditions such as a functioning Palestinian government or commitments one way or another regarding Hamas could embolden elements that undermine peace. How do you respond to concerns like that?
There's a lot of questions that come about as to what actually constitutes a Palestinian state and whether or not it meets the international definition of what a state is. Now, there's a lot of debate in the international community around that, Jeremy, whether it meets the Montevideo Convention of 1933. And some agree that it does and some say that it does not. But practically on the ground, right now, you don't have the territorial integrity of a Palestinian state while you have an occupation both in the West Bank and in Gaza, and a military advancement as well as the development and extension of Israeli settlements. So that in itself already puts a very precarious situation in the recognition of a two-state solution and makes it much more difficult when you have Benjamin Netanyahu responding to this declaration by the United Kingdom saying that he will not allow a Palestinian state to be established west of the Jordan.
There's also mention of a potential or possible backlash or even retaliation from Israel, perhaps in the West Bank or in expanding settlements. As a result then of this announcement at the weekend, what risks do you see and how do you think they might be mitigated?
From the statement that Benjamin Netanyahu had made in response, it does sound that the moment he steps down from the plane back from the United States, that he is going to implement something a lot more brutal than he has up until now. And he refers to the expansion of the settlements in Judea and Samaria, which is the West Bank. That in itself would mean that there would be an escalation of the violence that we've already seen. And last week, we saw mass arrests taking place in Tulkarm of Palestinians who are held under administrative detention. But concurrently, Jeremy, I think one of the things that really strikes me from the UK perspective, and I was just there, I just arrived yesterday, I witnessed some of the mass arrests that took place two Sundays ago when UK citizens had stood with placards, most of them over the age of 70, calling for an end to the genocide. And the authoritarian response from the state in arresting more than 800 of their own citizens simply for calling for the end of genocide and the end of the arming of Israel and the weaponization of Israel from the UK was very concerning to me because I witnessed it firsthand in Parliament Square. And to me, that is quite a dichotomy of what the UK is now saying in the recognition of the state of Palestine. It doesn't quite fit in terms of how they are responding and reacting and profiteering from a genocide. So it draws a lot of of questions. And what I'm hearing this morning from some of the people in the UK is that in the recognition of the state of Palestine, what this does is it also puts the UK under certain obligations. And one of them is that if there are British citizens serving in the IDF, they would then have to be arrested and called to prosecution for complicity in this, now that there is a recognition of a Palestinian state, because according to the UK laws, a British citizen cannot be serving in a military that is fighting another state that is at peace with Britain. So until now, they haven't declared being at war with Palestine, and that would then imply this kind of legal implications.
And Zinat, let me ask you a final question. All of this against the backdrop of the UN General Assembly that meets this week. How do you expect this issue to play out in New York?
We've already seen a lot of problems arising out of the Americans not wanting to give the Palestinian delegation visa to enter New York. There were questions about whether this would be moved to Geneva. There's a lot that has been going on behind the scenes in terms of trying to negotiate. And of course, this recognition comes ahead of the UNGA very deliberately. And we had the Arab states also making such a similar declaration after the attack on Qatar. But I find that it is really too little too late. It is applying a plan of a two-state solution that has already completely collapsed and failed. And it is a means of the international community to try and hold on to some semblance of international order that has completely collapsed in the wake of the genocide in Gaza.
Thank you very much, as always, Zinat Adam, Deputy Executive Director at the Afro Middle East Center. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.